bunch of people here interested in your in your title there, so it's all yours, Dr. Ricci.
Thanks, Murillo, and I'm excited to be here today. I really appreciate the opportunity to hear Kelly and Randy and Michelle and Bob. Great presentations, and I'm glad that I came this morning, particularly since I'm supposed to be speaking. Real quick, I'd like to recognize my co-author on this, Irish Pabayan. She hasn't actually seen the presentation yet, so that's kind of like going and buying a car and bringing it home and showing your wife, hey, guess what, we got a new car. I didn't tell you. Real quick, and this actually came out of some of her resource partitioning work, and I was interested in playing around with carbon resource partitioning and seeing what some of our bowl distribution work shows on an indeterminate crop. If you have corn or if you have wheat, it's kind of like having one kid, and you know that once the fruit comes out, that's where the resources are going to go. With cotton, not only do you know that you've got to partition resources to that area, but you also know that you've got to kind of balance it among several bowls. It's almost like having several kids. A few days ago during Christmas break, I actually told my wife, I said, honey, I don't think I want to have kids. And my wife said, so when are you going to tell them? The idea is that you've got this family conundrum where you have the potential for a lot of fruit, but at some point the plant's going to have to make a decision on what it's actually going to take to yield. This was described pretty well by Dr. Oosterhaus several years ago, this idea that you've got a bunch of squares here, and then eventually you're going to drop down to a set number of bowls, and that's going to remain pretty constant to the end of the season. So I actually have seven children. So I tried the indeterminate crop growth model with my family, and I'm here to report on what I've discovered. And so my oldest son, Brandon, he was born when I was still a senior at Utah State. And most of the time he was growing up, when he was 1 year old, I was making $17,000 a year as a graduate student. By the time my son Brent was born, he was born about a week before I defended my dissertation. And at the time, I was making $33,000 as a research technician. It turns out it's kind of stressful to have a kid born right when you're getting ready to defend your dissertation. And then by the time my daughter Lauren was born, I was an assistant professor, and I was making more than twice as much money as I was when Brent was born, and I was making several times more money than when Brandon was born. However, Brandon played sports. Brent didn't play sports because what I discovered as we started to get toward the end was, I had more money, but I had less time and I had less energy. And so this balancing act, at least in cotton, very much centers toward the center of your bowl distribution. So your first fruit are going to be carbon limited, your last fruit are going to be time limited, but at any given time, you've got a lot of resources that are committed to other fruiting sites. I found this article by Thornley and Hesketh from 1972, where they actually laid out the accumulation of mass and of carbon for a cotton bowl. This is the same Thornley that had the Thornley respiration model, and so I was excited when Michelle was talking about respiration, because I was interested in how can we talk in more detail about the respiration components. The text is kind of small here, so I blew it up into a graph just so that I can show you that, like most biological processes, the development of bowl mass over time is roughly sigmoidal. Now, this is the first day of flowering here. So if you go back to zero, you've got more or less a flat line here. you go out later in the season, you get more or less a flat line there. So we decided to use this model to see where the partitioning requirements are within the plant at a given time, both in season and at the end of season. And specifically to try to concentrate on these periods of overcommitment, these times when you have particularly large sinks within the plant, and what that does in terms of the plant making decisions or decisions being thrust upon that plant in terms of the retention of fruit. As I started doing this, I realized we had probably 20 or 30 site years worth of data that we could pull from to do this. And so I started small and things snowballed, so I've decided to cut back and just talk about a few of these. I'm going to briefly talk about a determinant situation that I looked at from work that we did with Jim Burdofsky a few years ago in Halfway, Texas, and then I'm going to spend some time looking at some of the indeterminate situations that we saw when I was at the University of Georgia. We mapped the fruit at the end of the season, and then I went back and I assigned fruit masses by days before and after flowering based on the Thornley and Hesketh description. So I did fruit per plant times mass per fruit is mass per plant. And so at any given time, it's not just how big are the fruit, but how many of the fruit are there on the plants. And then I took that, compared it to the total quantity of fruit on the plant, and we're looking for hot spots here. Here's an example of the mapping process. This is one of my former graduate students. You watch this on a loop, it goes on forever. They said that's pretty much like Robox mapping. But all of the fruit are assigned a node and position, and that node and position are then tied to timing. And what you discover when you do a lot of this is your second position fruit are going to occur simultaneously with the first position fruit that are two nodes higher on the plant, and your third position fruit are going to be four nodes below the first position fruit on the plant. So we combine those together because what we're interested in is total carbon dynamics by time rather than by, you know, is it first, second, or third position fruit. And then finally, I also broke it into fruiting zones because what I discovered was if we're looking only on a node by node basis, I think we even underestimate a little bit just how big the sink is in the middle of the plant, because you may have two or three nodes in a row that are each 25% of the biomass of the bowls at that point, but they're hidden because they're all 25%, whereas cumulatively they're like 75% of the plant. So we're going to look at that a little bit as well. So this is an example of LEPA irrigated crop in Halfway, Texas. This comes from work that we did with Jim Burdofsky, so thanks, Jim. What I would like to point out is here's a hot spot right here, right at the beginning, and you say, ooh, you know, we've got a lot going on here, but I'd like to focus more on this hot spot that you see right here. So you see a hot spot, you see a break, you see another hot spot. Focus on the second hot spot here. I broke this up. I really want you to focus on that second hotspot. And I would also like to point out, look how small that red region is, and look how much that red region spreads out and moves upward along the plant as we go later in the season, because I think that's important to the overall story. This is just to show that early in the season, you've got that hotspot right there, but these are very, very small fruit. And the plant isn't yet making the decision on what it wants to retain. It may have made some decisions on which fruit it's going to produce, but it's not to the retention point yet. So I went back to some work we did at the University of Georgia. These, I mapped 15 meters of plot at a time, three replicates over five locations, and then I never published it, so, you know. Don't do what I did, graduate students. But what I want to point out is the same pattern here. You have some material here, you've got a break, you've got a hot spot right here, and then it expands up the plant here. Those of you who remember 555, this is part of the reason I was interested in it. Very indeterminate crop, but you see this exact same pattern. The only difference is it's a little bit lower on the plant with a more determinant variety and it's a little bit earlier. On a less determinant variety, it's a little bit higher and it's a little bit later, but you see the exact same patterns. And I think the reason, because I've looked at several cultivars and you always see this gap here, I really think that it's related to that peak function, and at some point you kind of get a double dip occurring there. Oh, I better hurry, I'm down to 8 seconds. Murillo and Josh and Cameron, you have the right to come pull me off the stage when I go over time here. If you look at it by zone, look at this. These red marks here, these represent almost 70% of the yield in that plant is partitioned toward this zone 2, which is nodes 9 through 12. And so nodes 9 through 12 during this period of time account for 70% of the carbon partitioning of that plant at any given time. If anything, we underestimate the quantity of energy that we put right into the center of plant late in the season, because it starts to spread out as your later bowls start to take on mass. I checked to make sure this wasn't due to data enigmas, you know, big gaps in it, and so I smoothed it out. You actually see that pattern more in that case. This is with Delta Pine 555, again, the same pattern. So, a few things with this. First of all, the moment of truth in terms of, and you'll notice that these times here correspond very well with that period of time where you go from massive quantities of fruit to a set number of fruit that lead toward your final bowl complement. So your moment of truth actually happens well before you get environmental signals, cooler weather, day length issues. And I would say that there's a large evidence here that it's very much a carbon signal. Your end of the season bowl distribution, I think, obscures the level of sink strength, and the period of fruit shed coincides with this hot spot of the sink strength. So what does that mean in terms of my kids? First of all, The middle kids seem to be the most needy. It tends to kind of balance out, and I think what it is, you know, my younger kids don't get the same resources that my older kids do, but it balances out, and it's kind of hidden because later on when we're having to pay for their therapy, that's going to kind of balance it out on the back end here. With that, I would like to thank everyone who's participated in this project indirectly. This was something that, as I said, came out of a brainstorming session, and I've taken advice from several people related to this. And with that, do we have any time for questions? One question. All right. Well, thank you very much.